It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Throughout American history, many men and women have sought to change their names. Some immigrants to the country have done so in an attempt to assimilate, while others who were born here have done it to escape certain connotations of a given name. Whatever the reason, our guest historian says, the reason behind these name changes are often more complex than they seem. We'll take a look at who's changing their names and why, and what it all says about identity in America. Have you changed your name? If so, what were the reasons for the change? What about your ancestors? Did they change their name after coming here, perhaps? How important is your name to your identity, and would you consider changing it if it possibly meant a better life? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kirsten Vermenglish is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is Why Are Some Americans Changing Their Names? Kirsten, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
In your piece for The Conversation, you reference a 2008 Newsweek article on then-presidential candidate Barack Obama titled From Barry to Barack. Talk about that and the narrative it portrayed over that name change.
Well, I think that narrative is a really common one. It talks about his father, Barack Obama Sr., wanting to fit into American culture and taking on the name Barry. As sort of a way to fit in. They compare it to other, you know, immigrants who are German, taking on just sort of an easy American name. And then they talk about Barack Obama Jr. Deciding to take on, he would have been called Barry as a child, deciding to go back to the name Barack as he, searched for identity in a culture where he might have been more comfortable to use an African name and also was more concerned about African-American civil rights and sort of the compromises that African-Americans had to make in order to become American. And I think that this narrative of sort of, immigrants in a former time trying to fit in and, identity politics today making people much more comfortable with their names is a really common narrative that I think exists about American immigrants and American ethnic groups, I'd say, more broadly.
Well, that said, you say that your research on name changing suggests an even more complicated narrative. How so?
Well, so my research, I spent years actually looking at civil court petitions, name change petitions to the New York City Civil Court. So it's not all name changes everywhere, but I looked at thousands of petitions of people changing their names. And what I found was really surprising to me in two ways. The first is that petitions throughout most of the century, certainly the first half of the century, were majority Jewish, disproportionate to Jews' numbers in New York City. So there were many, many Jews changing their names. And 75% of them were native-born Americans. They weren't immigrants trying to fit in. They were already born in America. And I'm pretty sure they were changing their names. Their petitions don't always say so, but they pretty much allude to the fact that they can't get jobs. They can't get into schools without a Jewish name. This is a time of rampant anti-Semitism in America, where colleges are not accepting Jews when they have Jewish names. Employers won't hire people with Jewish names. And so there's a reason why so many Jews are changing their names. It's really because of racism. It's not because they're just trying to fit in to become American. They're already American.
What got you interested in these name changes in the first place? What drew you to this research?
Well, that's a good question, and sort of my glib answer is always that my name is Kirsten Vermenglish, and so why wouldn't I be interested in name changing? But the honest truth is I didn't change my name when I had the option. That women typically in America have the option to change their names when they get married, and I didn't take that option. So it's not like I really want to change my name, but I think I've always been fascinated in name changing, and I'm an American Jewish historian, so I've always been interested in kind of the boundaries that Jews create, you know, what makes somebody Jewish, what doesn't make them Jewish. And it's interesting how much Jewish names have been used as markers of who is Jewish, both for Jews and also for, quite honestly, disappointingly, for anti-Semites, for people who are looking to discriminate, having sort of a Jewish name. And those Jewish names are historically created. Jews took on last names later than most other Europeans, and so their names are frequently distinguishable in Europe and also in the U.S. And so names are sort of one of these really interesting places where people sort of delineate what are the boundaries of being Jewish, even though it really doesn't have anything necessarily to, you know, being Jewish in practice or in culture, you know. So I'm really interested in what those names signify for Jews and for non-Jews.
I was wondering if you'd been at least at all tempted to change your name, especially after a lifetime of people probably butchering it.
No, it's first true, use. And it always happens. Both my parents decided that, you know, I had a long, funny-sounding German last name, and so I should have a difficult-to-pronounce first name as well.
Yeah, why not?
Right. I thought about it when I was really young. You know, I would make up, you know, pen names and things like that, you know, and I'd think about, like, I think all girls in the 70s, you know, assumed they were going to change their names when they got married, you know, so I certainly did think about names, you know, changing names. But as I got older, I came to realize that my name was really a part of my identity. And so when I got married to my husband, it was important to me to keep my name. And actually, I gave my daughter my last name as well. So her last name is also an unusual first name and a last name that nobody can pronounce itself. But it doesn't bother me anymore. I don't mind correcting people. I never expect people to spell or pronounce my name right, but I'm really proud of it. And I think it's really interesting to think about the ways that names, I mean, one of the things I've learned in doing my work is how much names, you know, how much we identify them as, you know, our representations of who we are as individuals, but they also represent us to the outside world. They represent us to the government. And so they have a lot of meaning, you know, a lot of personal meaning, but it also means a lot to others. I've become very, very interested in sort of this double meaning or triple or quadruple meaning of names. They mean so much more than just, you know, what you call yourself, what you name your kid. You know, it has a lot of meaning to it.
Well, I wanted to change my name when I was a child. First, I thought John was kind of boring, and then the last name Munson, I got called Johnny Monster a lot. I didn't care much for that. Kirsten.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, we sort of, you know, when we took care to name our children, we also sort of thought to ourselves, you know, our kids will be made, you know, if kids are going to be made fun of, if people are going to joke around on the playground, they're going to joke no matter what name.
That's right.
Like with a name like Kirsten from English, I would never imagine somebody with John Munson would have troubles, you know, but everybody can find something with the name.
I'm still in therapy. Kirsten
right.
from English is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. We're talking about why people change their names and wondering what you might think about this. Give us a call. Have you changed your name? If so, why? What were the reasons for the change? Our guest has talked a little bit about how racism has played a part in why some people change their names. And was that maybe the case for you, or maybe one of your ancestors, somebody who first came here in your family, changed their name? Why did they do that? Did they change their name after coming to America? Did they change it before they came to America? Did it get changed at Ellis Island the way some people's did, just through clerical error, or was it intentional? And more importantly, how important is your name to your identity? Would you consider changing it if it possibly meant a better life? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email. The address is ideas@wpr.org, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kirsten from English stays with us as our conversation continues. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about why Americans change their names. Have you changed your name? If so, why? What about your ancestors? Did they change their name after coming to America, perhaps? How important is your name to your identity? Would you consider changing it if it meant a better life? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Kirsten Vermeglish is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. A recent piece for the website, The Conversation, is Why Are Some Americans Changing Their Names? Kirsten, we've talked about American Jews changing their names in the early 20th century and why they did that. How did we see the trend of name changing change later in that century?
So, yeah, it's interesting to sort of watch the chart I watched throughout the 20th century. And as anti-Semitism declines in the late 20th century, by the 1960s and 70s, the numbers of Jews changing their names goes down. And so do the number of name changers in general. They really sort of decline to really small numbers. And then, really interestingly, I think they really explode in the years after 2001. The population of New York City is really different. And the reasons for changing names are mostly really different. You see many more people of color changing their names, many people who are poor changing their names. The sort of the ways that Jews had changed their names back in the 1930s and 1940s is mostly really different for poor people of color today, you know, in the post-2001 era. Instead of hoping that they'll get new jobs, I think that for poor people of color, their concern is to be able to get things like, jobs and checks cashed and, to ease their help through a federal bureaucracy that since 9/11 has become way more concerned with security documents and way more anxious about, a misspelled letter, a misspelled name. One letter off on a name can mean that you can't get your checks cashed, or would mean that, you can't get, your Social Security, or you can't get your Medicaid. It's a really different kind of feel to go through the name change petitions now. You can still see people affected by racism, but in really different ways.
Let's take a phone call here. Dan is with us in Drummond. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. Well, the story that I'm told was the way we got our last name was one of the relatives went to vote about 1900 in Ashland, and when they were signing him up, they couldn't spell his last name. His last name was something like Poulet. And so instead of signing that, they put down Foley. And the relative had married a woman who was from Ireland, and since that name is so Irish, she latched onto it as though it had been in the family for generations.
Oh, interesting, Dan. Names being kind of changed by bureaucrats is also part of American history, isn't it, Kirsten?
Well, it's a story that's really frequently told. I've actually not heard a story of a name change at a voting in a voting space, so I think that's a really interesting story. Most historians and genealogists say that name changing probably didn't happen at Ellis Island. So that's the most common sort of bureaucratic story of people changing people's names. And there's certainly there's very little to no evidence that that happened at Ellis Island. But in terms of sort of officials, teachers, for example, being sort of representatives, civil servants who might say something like, oh, that name doesn't work, that name is too hard, you'll do better with an American name. Those kinds of stories, I think historians give more credence to. And so, a voting official I've not ever heard, but that's a really interesting story. And, certainly when bureaucrats have had sort of, controls over lists and things like that, I think, and, can sort of put down people's names, sometimes I don't know the veracity of stories like that, but they certainly do play a huge role in American history and in our understanding of ourselves.
Well, both of my parents had their names botched on birth certificates by people at the hospital who apparently weren't listening. And so that kind of thing can happen. I want to go back to your example of poor people of color actually changing their names and how that's related to security documents. I didn't quite understand the connection there.
So I think what happened after 9/11, and you know, this is sort of me piecing things together. Most of my research was of the earlier era and looking at Jews and looking at sort of anti-Semitism. But when I looked at a more recent era, what I found was really striking that people would say things like, you know, my birth certificate's been wrong since I was a kid. Nobody bothered to fix it. Maybe because somebody botched a name at a hospital, it's not clear. Either a misspelling or just a wrong name altogether. Maybe somebody, you know, was raised by a stepfather and, you know, had a wrong name on their birth certificate. So you see lots of people saying, I need to get a check cashed. I need to get a job. I need to get Medicaid. And this name, they won't let me get it if my birth certificate says something different than all my other documents. So I need to have this name changed. Mm. And I just see that on tons and tons of, I would say like maybe 25% of the documents, which is a pretty large number of the documents, much more so than in the early years. So what I would say is that actually throughout the 20th century, there's been more concern with documents. You know, even during the earlier part of the 20th century, you know, people to get jobs, you know, birth certificates became more a part of the, you know, process of changing your name. But it's really not until the 2000s that you see people saying, you know, I can't get what I need. You know, I can't get my checks cashed. I can't find a job. I can't get my Medicaid. You know, I can't get I can't get Social Security. You know, my name is, you know, my married name that I've been living with all my life, and now I want to get Social Security checks, and they won't give it to me because I've got my married name, and I have no other documentation for that. So my theory is that after 9/11, and I think there are other things in American history as well, concerns about immigration and things that have tightened. They've tightened our understanding of documents, basically. You know, that any misspelling, any misname is a limitation and a prohibition for people. But I think the reason that I think this makes poor people bear a heavier burden. I think that people who are middle class frequently, when they get into college or if they have, you know, a friendly HR department, you know, those kinds of things get smoothed away. You know, people are able to find some kind of way around those kinds of concerns. Mm-hmm. Whereas people who are poor, who don't have those kinds of institutions kind of smoothing things along for them, wind up getting more tripped up. That's the theory that I have, because I see so many people who are poor expressing these problems, and really the only people who are middle class, who, you know, who appear middle class given their jobs and their addresses in my documents, are frequently middle class women getting married. And
right.
Those are where middle class people show up much more in the roles, concerned about things like, you know, their having their documents match, is when women have gotten married and not changed their names and want to change their names at a later date. But otherwise, I think that the burden of, you know, sort of our greater concern about security, at least in these New York City files, seems to be borne more by people who are poor, who don't have people vouching for them, and who may be more reliant on, you know, government bureaucracy to get what they need.
Let's take another call here. We'll go to Casey in Milwaukee next. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I had two things. I just saw a funny little story that my neighbor recruiter told me years ago. His last name is now Ping, and he tells the story of when his grandparents came over here. They're Italian. Their last name was possibly Pingarelli or something to that effect. And they changed their name in New York City in order to avoid the racism with the Italian community there. Years later, he moved to California and experienced racism because now his name was Ping, and him and his wife couldn't find housing because they assumed that they were Asian or something. So I thought it was just an interesting story that they couldn't win, no coming or going, with changing their name.
Yeah.
Casey, thanks so much for that. Kirsten?
Yeah, no, that's a really fascinating story. I will say I absolutely did find it was, although I found majorities of Jews disproportionate, I absolutely also found Italians, usually as sort of a second or a third highest number every year. There was discrimination against Italians. That family is not alone in having experienced racism and looking to change names to be able to get jobs and be able to find their way through culture. And it's interesting that they chose a name that then could be identified with racism in other places. And you do see that, people changing their names to something that to their ears sounds like it's going to work. But in a different context, it winds up subjecting them either to discrimination against their own group. So, for example, Jews in an earlier year might choose Jewish names that sounded more established, more German, sort of more elegant sounding. But by the 1930s and 1940s, those names still subjected them to anti-Semitism. So it's interesting to have chosen a name that sort of refers to another group that's experiencing racism and then experience racism that way. I mean, that's a really interesting story. I haven't seen that particular story, but it doesn't surprise me at all. I think that's really interesting.
And Casey, thanks so much for that phone call. And Kirsten, we're out of time. What a fascinating discussion. I know we could talk about this for a lot longer, but we're going to have to move on. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Kirsten Vermeglish is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled, Why Are Some Americans Changing Their Names? Coming up next, our guest says single-use coffee cups may be the death of us all. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. How many coffee cups have you gone through in your life? Countless single-use coffee cups are thrown away every year because they're not easily recyclable. What's the problem of the ubiquitous single-use coffee cup, and why hasn't shunning them caught on in the same way giving up plastic straws has? Jen A. Miller is a freelance writer and the author of Running, A Love Story. She writes about running and the environment. Jen, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, some people might be thinking, why is this such a big problem? I mean, after all, these cups are made out of paper, right? So make the case that there is a problem that people should be thinking about.
Well, they are made of paper, but they're also lined in plastic, which means that they are not easily recyclable. Also, because they are in contact with human food, technically with human food and human bodies, there's a sanitation issue there. So while we think, oh, it's paper, it's not a big deal, it'll decompose or be recycled, that's actually not the case. So we're really just throwing these coffee cups into landfills.
So what exactly are they made out of?
I believe it's polyurethane. It's not polyurethane, I'm sorry, it's early here, but it's just a thin plastic lining. So it is cardboard on the outside. Now, I should say that's not the case everywhere. There's a lot of places that now use compostable cups, but they're still not able to be recycled because our recycling stream does not have the capacity to deal with that lining in those cardboard cups.
Oh, beyond the fact that these cups aren't actually recyclable, why is recycling not necessarily the answer generally?
Well, it's always better to reuse than to find something that's recyclable. I mean, that's good that we recycle. I'm just about to have the insulation in my attic redone, and it's using recycled jean material. But if we can reuse stuff, it's always better because it just adds less to the waste stream. And it doesn't have to be processed. My favorite reusable coffee cup is Captain America. I think that says some stuff about me. But also, if I use it over and over again, it doesn't need to be dealt with. All I have to do is wash it, and there's no waste involved in that.
Yeah, you know what? A lot of small-town coffee shops around America, people have their cups hanging on the wall. They have their name on them, so they don't have to worry about the disposable cup problem. Let's talk about the scale of this problem. How many of these faux paper coffee cups end up in landfills every year?
So in 2016, 250 billion paper cups were made globally, and that's by a market research firm called iMark, and they expect that number to hit 266 billion by 2022. But that also does include paper cups for cold beverages. So if you run the Twin Cities Marathon or any other marathon, you see those paper cups that people drink water and Gatorade from. Those are counted in that too, but largely it is these hot beverage cups.
Mm-hmm. We've been using paper cups for a long time now. Why are we just noticing this problem now?
Because we're drinking a lot more coffee than we ever did. So that cup that, if you've ever been to New York City, that Greek style cup that you get from corner vendors has been around since the 60s. Kander and Ebb had a song called Coffee in a Cardboard Cup from a show that was off Broadway, I believe, in the 70s. So it's a thing that we're used to, but we're just drinking coffee so much more now. And it's just a thing, like you're out with your coffee cup. If you've ever looked in any advertisement of like a nice fall day, somebody probably has a paper coffee cup in their hand. So it's just part of our society now, and maybe we're not thinking about what a problem it is.
So, but has the composition of these cups changed over time? I mean, didn't they used to use wax? Has it always been plastic in these disposable cups?
It's pretty much been the same concept of a cardboard cup with a lining in it since the 60s.
Okay.
Whether the lining has changed, it still doesn't make it recyclable, if that makes sense.
Got it. Jen Miller is a freelance writer and author of Running, A Love Story. She writes about running and the environment. We're talking about coffee cups and the problem that we have with them. This year, Starbucks, the European Union, and the Walt Disney Company all announced that they would eventually ban plastic straws and reduce some other single-use plastics. Cities around the U.S. are considering similar bans. So my question is, why aren't single-use coffee cups included in any of these bans?
So there's an incentive for brands like Starbucks to have their coffee cups around. So you think of the Starbucks logo, it's pretty iconic, that mermaid. And it's marketing for the company. I read it, it wasn't included in this story, but a small business vendor was writing pieces on their blog about why you should have paper cups as a branding device. So there's very little incentive for a lot of these companies to get rid of essentially the billboard that you're walking around with. Not the case of plastic straws. I mean, how many places do you know that brand their plastic straws? So some companies like Starbucks do offer a discount if you bring in your own cup, but it hasn't changed since the 1990s, as the price of Starbucks coffee obviously has gone up since then. So there is not as much an incentive for them to make the change to get people to stop carrying their billboard around as there is to do something about plastic straws.
So there is a push by some to create single-use cups that are biodegradable. Tell us more about that.
Yes, there is what some companies are calling the moonshot to create a completely recyclable coffee cup. It's called the Next Gen Coffee Challenge. And Starbucks and McDonald's are two companies that are behind this global consortium. They want it to be not only a fully compostable and recyclable cup, but also address issues on the recycle stream process to create technology that allows municipalities to recycle these cups where they can't right now. So the same is the case with if you get takeout in a compostable box. That box actually isn't recyclable, even though you might think it is. So it's the same sort of thing. Like, how do we make a coffee cup that can stand up to heat and not degrade, as a lot of corn – that's an issue somewhat with corn cups, right? Corn-based cups right now. How do we create a product that will be completely recyclable and compostable?
So this might be a unicorn instead of a moonshot.
Yeah, I mean, I think with enough money behind it, and there certainly is a lot of money behind it and a lot of big companies, it could be done, but it's still not the same as reusing a cup over and over again. So it's a good thing, but it's not the perfect solution.
Okay, well, let's talk about what individual consumers can do, because we could certainly use travel coffee mugs and refuse to use single-use coffee cups. But beyond that, what are some potential larger solutions to this problem?
Well, I think it's just, I mean, I'm talking on the radio about this, and I wrote this story, and now I had, you know, it sort of expands from there. I have friends who said, oh, well, I'm not going to buy coffee unless I have a reusable cup, and just put one in their car or their van. Some of it is pressuring these companies to ask, like, well, what are you going to do? There's a couple companies I profiled in this piece who are offering discounts to their customers. There's a place in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania, that gives you 10% right off the top if you bring in a reusable cup. There's a coffee shop near me in New Jersey where you can purchase their cup, and every time you use it, you get coffee for pretty cheap, like $2 off a cup, which isn't a small amount of money. So it's really on us to pressure these companies to say, well, what are you going to do? Otherwise, you know, I'm not going to come here anymore.
Well, and I guess if it starts hitting them in the pocketbook, they'll certainly notice that. Are local governments getting involved in this effort at all of maybe forcing the issue of single-use coffee cups?
Not that I know about. I mean, obviously there's a push to do this, but it's not reached the frenzy of the plastic straw issue to get that sort of attention from local governments right now.
And what happens if we don't do anything? I guess, is this really going to kill us eventually?
I mean, I don't know if it's going to kill us, but it just seems something that's such an easy thing to do to prevent these 250 million cups from ending up in landfills this year. It's just, I mean, how many conferences have you gone to, or Christmas gifts have you gotten, or company giveaways have you gotten that's a reusable travel mug? I mean, I had so many that I had to donate some to Goodwill. And I use them all the time. It just seems like something that's so easy, such an easy change for people to make, that we could do this and avoid a lot of waste, and you'll most likely save some money along the way.
Are there coffee shops that won't let you bring in your own mug?
Not that I'm aware of. There are some coffee shops that have told me, because I ask every time I go in and I bring my cup, I was like, well, what do you want to do? Just to make sure, like, how do you charge for this, or how much am I going to pay? They just ask that they're clean, because you don't want some sort of gross, grody coffee cup being behind the counter there.
Yeah. Is the damage already done here? I mean, we have tossed a lot of coffee cups. We're talking billions, hundreds of billions of coffee cups.
Well, I think we have sort of the same way. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, you know, throwing Pepsi cans in the trash before recycling was a thing. They're still sitting in landfills. But if we're aware of the problem, we can certainly make a change for the future and just not make this continue over and over again to just make it worse.
So this is a problem that we can manage, but we're really going to have to take some action. How do we, we're talking about this on the radio, as you point out, you've written about it. What else can we do to get some policy changes made here? Because it seems to me like somebody's going to have to take some leadership on this issue.
Well, I think there's a group called Stand Earth that I interviewed for this story that is sort of promoting the next gen cup challenge, just to get the word out about it, which is the recyclable challenge. But also their initiatives are that they are lobbying to make these kinds of products that can't be recyclable sort of not illegal, but pressuring companies to do this. They were part of the group that is supporting what Starbucks and McDonald's is doing, but they're still out there saying, hey, this is good, but the best solution is to just not throw stuff away that has to be dealt with in any way. So learning from an organization like Stand Earth and supporting them is a great way to get involved.
And what about putting pressure on coffee shops and local governments to do more?
I would, every time I go somewhere and it seems like a barista is not, like they've never had a cup presented to them, which has definitely happened, just talk to them about it and say, hey, you know, if you offer a discount for people like me, then you have to spend a lot less on your coffee cups, and that's just a reduced expense for you.
Bottom line, that's always the way to go. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Jen Miller is a freelance writer and the author of Running, A Love Story. She writes about running and the environment. Jen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, the problem with plastic. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. When plastic was first invented, it seemed like a modern miracle. Now we're drowning in the stuff, and it's destroying our environment. There's a 600,000 square mile patch in the Pacific Ocean that's a giant floating garbage dump full of plastic. But what if we could suddenly free ourselves from all this plastic? Beth Terry has. She's the founder of the blog My Plastic Free Life and author of Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. Beth Terry, welcome to The Morning Show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
If someone wants to reduce the amount of plastic they use, where should they start?
Well, First of all, this is not a one-size-fits-all solution, because some people, what's easy for me but might not be as easy for somebody else. But in general, bringing a reusable bag when you go shopping is one way to start. Just skip plastic bags. And then bringing a reusable bottle with you or a reusable mug, that's another thing. Those are two pretty simple things. But then after that, it really depends on the individual and their lifestyle. And when I first started my project, I was collecting my plastic waste every week and looking at it and analyzing it. I know that might sound weird to some people, but it was actually very educational, and it helped me figure out in what areas I was using a lot of plastic and where I could cut back.
Well, let me just ask you this, because I think this will be a great place to jump in.
Okay.
Where do people tend to use the most plastic in their day-to-day lives?
Generally, food packaging. You know, when you go to the grocery store and look at the shelves nowadays, it's just row after row after row of plastic packaged and pretty much processed foods. And so figuring out ways to buy groceries without plastic, and also nowadays ways to avoid takeout and delivered foods without plastic is really important. And I'm actually seeing a lot more plastic now with the rise of delivery. Delivered meals, which is increasing.
So when you were doing your survey, when you were collecting all your plastic and analyzing it, was that what you found? Was that you were seeing most of your plastic in food packaging? Where else did you see it?
Well, of course, I saw it in the bathroom. Every personal care product I used came in plastic. Every cleaning product that I used came in plastic. And then, you know, we think about packaging, we think about single-use disposable plastics as being the biggest offenders. But then we look at our clothing. Most clothing these days is made with synthetic fabrics, which is a type of plastic and which breaks down in the wash into microplastics. Pretty much everything that we have in our daily lives has some plastic in it. And so a lot of this is a matter of prioritizing and figuring out what are the easiest ways to cut back first, and what would have the biggest impact.
Beth Terry is the founder of the blog My Plastic Free Life and author of Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. We're talking about the problem of plastics and what we can do about it in our own lives. Well, some things, don't seem to be too challenging. I mean, we could all probably manage to bring a reusable water bottle or coffee mug wherever we went, our own containers for leftovers when we eat out.
Absolutely.
But you just pointed out that there's plastic in my clothing, and, you know, that's not something that most people would think of. There's probably a lot of other places where there's hidden plastic. So what can we do then to reduce our use of plastic in a meaningful way?
You know, when I first started this project, I lived on frozen microwavable meals in plastic containers and energy bars wrapped in plastic, and pretty much all my food was in plastic because I didn't want to have to learn how to cook or make foods from scratch. And I have learned that by avoiding processed foods and looking for foods from the produce aisle, not taking those disposable produce bags, looking for foods from bulk bins, bringing my own containers for those, shopping at farmers markets, I've found ways to get better food, healthier food, that's better for me and that doesn't come with a lot of plastic packaging.
You know, the idea of bulk and things like that isn't really a new one. And I'm old enough to remember selling produce in a grocery store where we packaged everything in paper sacks and wrote the price on it. And then you took it up to the checkout. Maybe we need to get back to that. But the idea of completely giving up plastic is pretty daunting. I mean, people might be saying, okay, how can I possibly make a difference here? And by the way, I'm already recycling stuff. What's so bad about reusable plastic?
Yeah, so recycling is not the solution that a lot of people feel like it is. First of all, most people don't realize that our plastic recycling, for the most part, gets shipped overseas. The most recycling in the United States actually happens in the developing world. It had been happening in China, and there's a lot of pollution that's created in other countries due to recycling practices that are less than environmentally friendly. And recycling is a market. So if there's if the market is down and there's no one to buy the plastic, it's, you know, putting it in the recycle bin might as well just be a roundabout way of sending it to the landfill. And plastics are mainly downcycled.
Yeah. Well, what about reusable plastic, like the plastic containers that I use to put the chili I make with the beans I bought at the farmer's market into the freezer for eating later on? I reuse these all the time. What's wrong with those?
Yeah. So I am all for reusing plastic items that you already have, but not when it comes to food, because plastics contain additives, and many of those additives are endocrine disruptors. They affect the hormones in our bodies, and they're more likely to leach out of plastics when they're subjected to extremes of temperature or rough treatment or light. So freezing, microwaving, putting them in the dishwasher, that's going to be more likely to release those chemicals. When I was going through this, I didn't go through my house and purge all the plastic, durable plastic products that I had. I just repurposed them for other things, non-food storage things.
I referenced the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in the intro to this segment, and it's more than 500,000 square miles. Some estimates are as much as 600,000 square miles. It's twice the size of Texas. Plastics threaten the lives of sea creatures and other animals, but it's still everywhere, and it's just a part of daily life for most people. Why are small individual changes so important in the face of what feels like an impossible problem?
Yeah. Well, first of all, small individual changes are not enough, even though that's what I focus on. And through my website and through my book, I try to help people figure out how to make those changes. We do need change on a systemic level. We need our governments to step in and regulate plastics. We need companies to come up with alternatives. But for that to happen, for companies to come up with alternatives, they have to know there's a market for them. And so by switching what we purchase from plastic to non-plastic, we're supporting companies that are giving us alternatives. We're creating that market. That's just one of the reasons that personal changes are important. It's also important because when you start reducing the plastic in your life, then you see how much there is and you see the areas in which we need change. But before you start doing it, it's kind of invisible.
Yeah, you're talking about major systemic changes, and do you have how optimistic are you that we're capable of actually doing it? Because we haven't proven it so far.
No, we haven't. But I feel optimistic when I see campaigns out there to reduce plastic bags, to reduce styrofoam, to reduce plastic straws. I mean, this is, I think there we have to get to a tipping point, and I do see a lot of movement more recently than in the last 10 years since I've been doing this. So I am optimistic, but also we have to keep going.
So if someone wants to learn more about this, what resources would you recommend?
Well, there's a newish campaign called Break Free from Plastic, and I would definitely recommend people look into that. The Story of Stuff project is also working on plastic issues, for example, microplastics, and the Plastic Pollution Coalition. And if you're looking for ways to reduce plastic in your own life, check out my website, myplasticfreelife.com, and there's a list of my top 100 ways to reduce plastic.
Beth Terry, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Beth Terry is the founder of the blog My Plastic Free Life and author of Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.